When you hear the name Moses, you don't think of magic and a murder mystery. But today's author, Rand Flemeth, and his wife, Rose, will talk to us about the biblical figure who we have heard about in churches, seen in movies, and read in the Bible. And today's show just might shock you and for sure start to make you think. Rand is an author of other books such as The Atlantis Blueprint and When the Sky Fell in Search of Atlantis. But we will focus today on his latest book, The Murder of Moses. This is Truth Be Told. I'm Tony Sweet with... Welcome to Truth Be Told.
Okay.
Wow. That was an abrupt... Hey, everybody. It's Tony Sweet and Captain Ron. We are so excited to have you guys here with us. And we have a great guest, as you heard. So it's Rand. Are you there?
I sure am.
There he is, our guest. There he is. Thank you so much for doing this. It's going to be a great time.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
All right, so we have this one thing about Truth Be Told. We touch on so many different topics, and this was one that I thought was very interesting because, you know, for over 2,000 years, you know, we've heard so much about Jesus and Moses, and I've heard different stories about who they were, but I've never heard this story about Moses being murdered by a magician.
This. So
can you kind of fill us in on what the book is about, and then we'll get in and figure out how you found out the research to how this story went down.
Well, it was Sigmund Freud that was the first person to really get into this idea that Moses had been murdered and replaced by an imposter. And he this was in his very last book that he published, and it was published in English in September 1939, and that's the year he died. So, you know, that's when the war broke out. There wasn't a lot of people focusing on his book, his last book, and it sort of kind of just faded away. Earlier, Goethe had been the first person who to suggest that that Moses had been murdered, and so there was a little bit of interest in the strangeness of the story of Moses, his abrupt change of character. Sometimes he's like a humble, I'm not worthy, and the next thing you know, he's commanding, a very commanding, charismatic character. So, we wondered whether, is he schizophrenic, or was there a possibility, which both Goethe and Freud both thought, that there were two Moseses, and the first one was very much more of a meek, introvert. Contemplative figure, and the second one was very much almost like a warlord, very, very expressive, dramatic. So the contrast between them has always confused people who read the Bible. When you're reading about Moses, you can't know whether is he. You know, this meek guy, a humble guy, or is he this incredibly charismatic, boisterous person?
Is that your source material, the Bible itself, or is there other texts you're using to find out about Moses?
Well, yeah, that's where it was really interesting for me, because we believe that, like, a lot of the texts that got into the Old Testament had been tampered with by one of the characters who was in cahoots, if you like, with this magician who killed and then impersonated Moses. So in order to get a, triangulation on that question, we turned to Jewish folklore. And the folklore is very important because... For about a century, there was a united kingdom. There was Israel in the north and Judah in the south, and they had very different stories about what was happening. Eventually, Israel was overtaken by the Assyrians, and that nation died. Judah continued on. So the people who came from Israel were then kind of refugees in their neighbors' land. They didn't. So in order for their stories to be told, they had to do it in through Jewish folklore, because the Levite scribes in Judah pretty well had a clamp down on what was being said about what had happened. So in order to sort of lift the lid on that a little bit, we make quite a bit of use of Jewish folklore, because that's a way of seeing what the motives of the people from Israel were, whose stories were to a large degree suppressed in the Old Testament. There's also the Egyptian accounts and the Roman accounts as well. So, you know, which are not really well known. We know Josephus was a writer around the time of Christ who did a history of Egypt. And he relied upon an Egyptian historian called Manetho. And Manetho had his own story of what had happened with Moses, which again is not well known, in which he sees him as being born in Heliopolis, and becoming a leader of what they called lepers. But one has to understand that the leprosy was a term that was used polemically as well, if you like. It was like anybody who had polluted ideas or ideas that you didn't like, you would call them lepers. And Manetho thought of Moses as a leader of lepers because he thought the ideas that he was putting forward, monotheism, had been rejected conclusively by the Egyptians after Akhenaten, the pharaoh, had originally proposed them. And then when he died, the Egyptians turned against that idea. It then became a secret a religion in the house of Heliopolis. And we believe that's where the first Moses was actually born.
This literally seems like the first conspiracy and the first secret society. Wasn't it sort of a secret society?
It was a very important secret society, and that's certainly what Freud was. Freud's the thing that Freud wasn't able to do, which he was really, his whole theory was based upon the idea that the first Moses was a follower of Akhenaten, who had learned somehow from the priests of Heliopolis. Where Akhenaten had been educated, this idea of a single god. Heliopolis was a place that the temple of Heliopolis was a place where Freud needed to get Moses to and was never able to. And the reason that was the case was that Freud didn't really take the study of sources as seriously as we do in our book, and he hadn't really and he swallowed completely the genealogy that had been given to Moses by the Levites, who were the scribes. As a result, he was never able to get Moses into the temple of Heliopolis. Now, when you look at the Romans and the Egyptian accounts, they believe that Moses was the third son of Joseph, the famous rags-to-riches guy who was thrown in the pit, and just a wonderful story. It's like one of the. It's clearly the most enthralling story in the Old Testament. You'd have to say, you know, the guy goes from being thrown into a pit, then he's sent off to be a slave in Egypt, and he just kept. And no matter what he gets thrown at him, he rises up. We believe that eventually a Levi, who was older brother to Joseph by a different mother, got into a conspiracy to kill Joseph. And when they did kill Joseph, that's when the Egyptians decide, okay, you guys got to get out of here. And that's when everybody left. But Joseph had been married to the priestess of Heliopolis. Her father was the high priest. And the high priest of Heliopolis was the number one astronomer in Egypt, like the highest position in Egypt at all. And Heliopolis was like the place, the city of the sun. And so we believe that the Moses was born as the third son of Joseph after the Israelites had been expelled, and that's how the Egyptians put it forward, as an expulsion, rather than set my people free. It's mortal. You guys got to get out of here because you killed this important person, Joseph. So when you have that different perspective, when you take seriously the Egyptian perspective, then the notion that of having monotheism, which originated in Heliopolis, and Freud not being able to get Moses there, we have him actually being born in Heliopolis, and that's what the Egyptian account says, raised as the grandson of the high priest. So he was able to get into the secret society of that temple, and that's where the notion of a single God was eventually brought to the rest of the Israelites when Moses had to leave because the Pharaoh, who had been sympathetic to Joseph, died, and the new Pharaoh wasn't having any foreigners around.
It just seems like this is so hard to chase back data that far back. How confident in this are you? I mean, unless it's written in stone somewhere, it seems to me like it would be very hard to track this.
Yeah, well, I understand what you're saying, and certainly that is true. It is difficult. However, the thing that I believe that what we've done with the murder of Moses is we've made the story coherent. There, you can see what the motives of the people were, what their means of carrying out their task were, and it happened to be magic, acts of illusion, and you can see the opportunity that they would have had. It's I think what we do is with this history, and because, like you say, it's a long time ago. But then there are a very ancient texts as well. And then you have the folklore as well. So a lot of the stuff, when you bring it all together, it starts to be coherent. Whereas I don't believe the story of Moses, as it's represented, as we see it in the Old Testament, it seems very disjointed and out of kilter. First of all, you don't even know he has a sister until he's been in an ark going down the Nile. You don't know he has a brother until years, like decades later, when at the burning bush suddenly Aaron shows up, mm-hmm. And What I'm saying is that when you take the story apart and you have other pieces that aren't from the Bible, like the Roman and the Egyptian sources, and you have the folklore, and then you have more pieces to put the puzzles together. And when the puzzle comes together, it becomes more coherent than what we have today that is just in the Bible today.
What was Freud's fascination? How did he even... Because with all the studies he's done and books he's written, it was kind of a stretch for him. What was his fascinating with this subject?
Well, he started in 1901. I guess the answer to your question is that he had the Oedipus complex with the mother you know, the mother, the child wants to have, sleep with the mother. Mm-hmm. So he's looking for a father figure to be equivalent to the mother figure. And he thought, well, that probably was Moses. Moses was like the father figure. Mm-hmm. So he became obsessed, like he felt as if to complete his psychoanalysis, a prehistory, he needed not just only the story of sleeping with your mother, but he also needed this killing of the father. And he became, so that's where he saw it as a missing piece to his overall theory of prehistory. Wow. So he was obsessed with it. But at the same time, he was afraid to publish about it. And even when he published anonymously.
Oh, really?
And all his friends were saying, don't do it. Don't do it. Because, you know, the times are not right for people to be questioning the leadership of...
Do you get that?
Pardon?
Do you get that when you publish your book? Do people say, look, don't even try to say that? Like, do religious people challenge you?
Well, you get some reactions. You know, I think most people really, they're not really, a lot of people are just not tuned into to that. And the whole, there's, people get their knowledge of the Bible through movies as much as they do from reading the Bible. So, and those movies are really, you know, standard pieces and set pieces. So I think our work does break up a lot of the assumptions about that traditional story and brings in a more coherent story. So, no, the answer, I haven't had a lot of people. There's some people are upset about suggesting that there were two Moseses, but most people nowadays, they just don't really care.
Right.
Oh, that's honest.
Right, it is honest. I mean, from, you know, what we've read and what we see, I remember, you know, Charlton Heston, you know, Ten Commandments was, to me, you're talking about a magician kind of tricked him and murdered him, but in a lot of ways, wasn't Moses a magician in ways? Because with a lot of the things that, parting the Red Sea, the serpents and so many other things, was he also a magician?
Well, you know, even in the traditional story, Moses is raised in Egypt by the Pharaoh's daughter, which was like just a way of explaining his knowledge of magic, Egyptian magic. He was definitely educated in all of the roles of the magician. Now the magician, it was also a priest. He was also an astronomer. He was a doctor. There wasn't all these divisions like there is today of the professions. Like really, basically, you were talking about the educated people and people who were magicians who served the royal family were called priests. But magicians who were serving other people, just ordinary people, giving them, they were called magicians. So, but they were doing exactly the same things. They were giving them the same amulets to ward off the demons. They were giving them things to say and would use hypnotism on them to calm them. So, like, all the skills of the magician, even in the traditional story, the first that Moses had. The difference with Reuel, to get into this magician Reuel, because magician Reuel, he's more frequently known as Jethro for Christians, because he's the father-in-law of Moses. You know, he's a strange character because here he is. He's living in the time of Israel, Jacob. So his father is Esau, who is a twin with Jacob. And those two, the conflict between those two is really the source of a lot of the story. Isaac was the very first person to be considered the founder of the Jews. His wife, Rebecca, gave birth to twins. The firstborn was Esau, and a couple of minutes later, Jacob. Jacob later became known as Israel. So Jacob, when they grow up...
So many of these guys have more than one name. How do you keep any of this straight? Well, it was Jacob, but he went by Israel, but he was the son of Joseph, who was known as this other guy.
Right.
I've heard you speak before, and you have all these guys are known as other guys. How can you keep it straight?
That happens. you know, it does happen in the Bible quite frequently. Even Abraham was really originally called Abram. You know, so in any case, Jacob, whose name means deception, because he deceived his father by impersonating his brother. He was the second born, and he wasn't going to. He conspired with his mother to get the birthright and the blessing of Isaac, so that he could become a leader of the of the Hebrew people. And he impersonated his brother, his older brother. Now, his older brother Esau had a son called Reuel. Reuel is, or as he's well known, he's got other names besides Reuel. And in the story, we show that he changes his persona quite often. But he found that his uncle, Jacob, had stolen what he considered to be his birthright. So he had a thing against all the children of Israel because, you know, he felt as if they were illegitimate. They had impersonated, Jacob had impersonated Reuel's father to steal the leadership of the Hebrews. So to get revenge to do that, he then kills Moses and impersonates Moses with wearing a mask so that nobody can see his face.
When somebody catch on to this?
I was gonna say how, you know, back then, I wouldn't think nowadays, you know, we could... Unless you have like Hollywood digital, how would that happen?
Well, here's the thing about the mask. There's two masks. He has this shining face, which is when he comes down from the mountain of God. Mm-hmm. His face is shining. This is Reuel, incidentally, and his face is shining. Now everybody looks away because they believe that if you even see the reflection of God through the face of Moses, that you will die instantly. So it's a very effective mask, you know. Shining face, look away, because if you see it too closely, you will die. So that's a very effective way of preventing anybody looking at your face. Then, when he wanted to do to govern, he put a veil over his face. Okay, so now they could listen to him. They weren't afraid of dying, but they couldn't see his face. They could only see his eyes. So it's a double mask. It's a very effective way of hiding your identity. If people believe that if you look at them, you die, and then when you do look at them, you can only see this veil, then you don't get to see who they really are.
Hmm. I know that Moses didn't get to see the promised land. Could this be one of the reasons why that God, I mean, if you bring in God, could God wanted to make sure that generation was gone because of the murder of Moses to get them to the next? I don't know. I'm a little confused, but because I know he died before they got to the look where they wanted where they were going. Is that correct? Right?
Yeah. Well, certainly the way it's very very odd because there's different parts to the Bible and there's different sources,
right.
And only one source gives an account of his death, and that's Deuteronomy. The other sources and there's like four other ones, they don't even give an account of his death. And and Josephus gives a completely different account of his death. He's just standing between two people, a puff of smoke comes up, they look up, and then the cloud disappears, and he's gone. So it's like a magician disappearing on the stage. That's like he used pits, you see. There would throw up the cloud. A cloud would rise up. The guys that were beside him would be looking up. And when the clouds disappeared, he wasn't there. He just went down the pit, you see. So there's different stories of his account of his death. I understand the theological idea that he wasn't allowed to go. It seems rather the reason that they give that he can't get into the Promised Land is rather petty, really. He struck rather a rock when he wasn't supposed to. It was very, very, a misdemeanor, hardly an offense that would call you out of not being able to get to the Promised Land.
Right.
So the whole thing about his death is very suspicious. There's the complete lack of a detail, and especially from the Levites, who are the main writers of the Old Testament. They don't have anything to say about his death. They just, like, ignore it.
That's very interesting. Hey, Rand, so you're saying that the Moses that we've all heard of that came down with the
burning
Ten Commandments,
yeah,
and spoke to the people, they saw that he had just talked to God, and they wouldn't look at him, right? So that's like this moment was this impersonator of Moses, right?
That's right.
Well,
you know,
hold on, Rand. If that's when he's the impersonator, when he went up there, wouldn't God know?
Right. I'm doing this as history. I'm not doing this as theology. So, like, I can't invoke God. Well, of course, you know, if you're invoking God and you're believing that's
well, I mean,
that
just seems like chink in the armor or whatever. That if he went up to talk to God to get the commandments to give to the people, if he spoke with God, you think God would know that this is a magician and not Moses because God knows everything.
Or did Ruel actually was he part of the
He's such a good magician that he pulled one
really
over on God?
Believe,
yeah, right.
Okay, well, I don't really believe that he went up and encountered God.
Yeah, that's what
the
I was
guy
say.
That went up was the first Moses. He had brought monotheism as a theory of religion, but then he was murdered on the mountain, and the guy who came down had this shining face and then the mask to impersonate him. And so the first thing he did, incidentally, was order the death of 3,000 people who had
followed Moses.
God did the gold had worshipped a golden calf.
Oh, yeah.
So it was sort of a coup.
I couldn't believe that Rael would be the only person in on this. So there must have been a whole.
Oh no! No, we believe that it was really a dual thing. It was
a second
Levy.
Shooter,
right.
Yeah. Levy and Rael together did this together.
Mm.
Levy was became the scribe. He became the first priest. All the priests were Levites. He was the third son of Israel, and we believe that Moses came from the other wife, Rachel, who was a son. So, yeah, let's see. I'm not sure where I would like to go with that. Ruel had a strong motive. His father had been lost, the leadership of the Hebrew. He had means. And let's get to the means, because the son of a king, because his father Esau, even though he had been disinherited, he went on and conquered this land and created this country called Edom, and so he was a king of Edom, and Ruel was a prince. So in those days, they were under the Egyptian influence, and it was a policy of those in those days for the sons of the kings to go to Egypt to get their education. So Ruel was off as a fairly young man and became went into the whole learning. There was called a House of Life, a place where he would learn hypnotism, magic acts of illusion. He would learn astronomy. He'd learn being a physician. He had all this education. So he had, and he understood how to use illusions to persuade people that he's actually acting on behalf of supernatural forces. So that's what that was all about, and we spent quite a bit of time in The Murder of Moses about what it was like to be a magician in Egypt, because all the skills that you had there became necessary later to carry off this impersonation without people really realizing it was happening.
When I first started looking into this, I first thought of shapeshifters, you know, or because we, you know, truth be told, we talk a lot about UFOs, aliens, and that's what I didn't know if that was part of the now that you explain it, I can see what they were talking about. But at first I thought, well, maybe it was a shapeshifter that why people did not know it was Moses, because, you know, yeah. I mean, I would. If I look at Captain Ron, which is hard for me to do, but
sure,
but you know, I would know. But that makes pretty much sense. But now, so do you think that Ruel was more of like an advisor, because to get Moses to the top of the mountain and see the burning bush, do you think that was, I mean, if it was fabricated, do you think that he was feeding him all along of trying to build up something bigger than it was just so they could plot the actual
event?
Let me
explain the relationship between Ruel,
please.
And Ruel was a high priest. He had all these skills from Egypt. When the first Moses, and I'm going to call the first Moses Osirsef, because that's what the Egyptians call him, Osirsef, which is a combination of Osiris and Joseph. When he was left in Egypt, his mother was the high priest of Heliopolis. His grandfather was his only male model, his grandfather, and his grandfather was the highest priest in the land of Egypt, and so. He was spending a lot of time meditating in the temple, and he would be working with his grandfather, and his grandfather would eventually reveal these secrets of monotheism and other things that normal people wouldn't, even people who had come from other lands, wouldn't get to see. But since he had been born to his born there. To an Egyptian mother, he was able to interact with this high priest. So when he left Egypt and he went to Midian, that's where all the other Israelites were, and Ruel was the high priest there. So he transferred, Osirsef transferred this sort of adoration of the older man to Ruel. So Ruel was, teaching him, he would come and meditate with Ruel, and Ruel eventually got into hypnotic suggestions for him. And you know, so he had this kind of control over him that he was vulnerable because his normal experience with prayer or meditation was with a high priest in Egypt, and so he just transferred that to Ruel. So Ruel was able to exploit his position as high priest in Midian to take a good control of Osirsef until he no longer needed him. He needed him, however, to produce some children. See, Ruel felt he had the most noble bloodline that had ever existed, because he could trace himself to Abraham, the founder of everybody, through his father, who was who was Isaac, and then to Abraham, and then through his mother, who was a daughter of Ishmael, who was the first Arab. So Reuel was the first person to have both Jewish and Arab blood. Mm. And that gave him a real sense of entitlement and also really wanting to control that bloodline, which we show he was able to control right straight down for centuries after all of this happened. And even today, there are people who are descendants of him, a million people who practice a secret religion. And some of them are in California. Some of them are in Manitoba. Hmm. Most of them are in Lebanon and Israel. But there's a million people who claim descent from Reuel.
So what was the final verdict when it comes to how it changed history? With Moses leading everyone out of Egypt, and he had his, his theory, in God, and his plans on the promised land. But once Reuel took over, how did it change history? Because it doesn't sound like it was a positive thing in the long run, or was it?
Here's the way Freud thought, and we agree about him on this sense. The first Moses was like, he was kind of a hippie character. He didn't do sacrifices, like, because his gruel bottle would have been Akhenaten. Mm-hmm. No human, no animal sacrifices, no wars. Flowers and this kind of thing. So he's very, very a peaceful person, a meditative person. But that type of person was going to be able to lead the people into to the promised land. Mm-hmm. And so Reuel, who was rather ruthless, was able to accomplish the task of moving the people from what was Saudi Arabia. Parts of Saudi Arabia in through Jordan, all the way into the Promised Land, which at that time was becoming vacant. It isn't so much a conquest; that's certainly the way Israel archaeologists see it. They see it more of there was this big, long, extended drought, and then there was a technological innovation of cisterns where they could store water. And so a land that had been vacant, Palestine, was suddenly open, and that's how the Israelites got there. And they wouldn't have got there without the leadership of Reuel, is how I would say is in terms of impact upon history.
Hmm. Well,
because Osterseff was just too passive a character to be able to carry that out.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left. I want to ask a little bit about your Atlantis book, but I do want to ask one more question about this. When in the Old Testament, so when it was written, it sounded more like the original Moses, a little more PC maybe. I don't know. Or was it written more as Reuel?
It's actually Levi, and the Levites. They're the ones who Levi incidentally is the guy who really conspired to kill Joseph, and threw him in the pit. And he was really the leader of that. So the whole battle of the Old Testament is really a battle between Levi and Judah and Joseph and Israel. That's the main conflict that exists there. But Levi, became the scribes, and they were the ones who told the story. And since they were implicated in the plot to kill Joseph's son, because they hated Joseph in the first place, they kill him, and then they adopted him into their family and said, "Oh no, he was a Levite all along." This is the story of changing of the genealogy to make the Levites seem as if they were descended from Moses, when in fact he was descended from Joseph.
Well, the book, The Murder of Moses, how an Egyptian magician assassinated Moses, stole his identity, and hijacked the Exodus. So you can get those books pretty much anywhere. You can go to intertraditions.com. But I want to, in the last remaining minutes we have, I can't believe it's already gone by so fast, but you wrote a book, Atlantis Beneath the Ice, and several others. But what's funny is right now the Antarctica is really a lot in the news now with, you know, the melting of the ice and a lot of reveals in the UFO stuff. But can you talk to us about the reveals of the Earth crust shifting? Because this is interesting that you say that dragged Atlantis into the polar zone beneath the Antarctic.
Yeah, the theory of Earth crust displacement put forward by Charles Hapgood in the 1950s, and I corresponded with him for the last few years of his life, is the idea that the outer shell of the Earth, the entire outer shell, it's only like 1/3 of 1% of the Earth's mass, can periodically shift over the interior, so that don't think of it like as plate tectonics as moving the continents moving in relationship to each other. It's actually the whole outer shell moving relative to the Earth's axis. So what you have is you have places that are in the polar zones can move into the temperate zones. Other places that are in the temperate zones can move into the polar zones. It's the crust moving, and this climatic zones are stable. But since the crust is moving, you get to places like North America, mm-hmm. which had been prior to the displacement in the polar zones, and that's why there was such a big ice sheet on North America, and why North America is such a water-rich continent, because it has all these lakes that are remnants of that ice sheet. And then over in Siberia, for example, which was outside of the polar zone before the displacement, you had lots of animals, almost like the African savanna. So what we found is that when you look at what's called the Antipodes, like North Pole, South Pole. If you look at Siberia and you look at what was happening there during the Ice Age, you'll find it was a lot warmer than it is today. Mm. If you go right straight through the center of the Earth, you pop out on the Western Antarctica, and we believe that Western Antarctica, the part that is towards South America, was temperate before the last displacement, and that was the site of Atlantis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay. That's interesting.
And Plato's account of Atlantis is an accurate depiction of the Earth as seen from Antarctica, of the whole Earth as seen from Antarctica. That's sort of central to our notion. I'd like to say a couple of things, just about what I would call curiosity portals.
Sure.
The thing that got me into, I believe that anomalies are the way, are signposts to discovery. Mm-hmm. And when you find things that are strange, curious, obscure, or inexplicable, then that can become a curiosity portal. For me, the very first curiosity portal that I ever had was this Athanasius Kircher, a German Jesuit priest, published a map in 1665 of Atlantis, and it turns out to be a relatively accurate map of Antarctica without its ice. And this is like 300 years before they knew what it looked like under there. So that was what I would call my curiosity portal that made me go into that. So once I go through that portal, then I look to the history of the discipline, and I don't ignore the contemporary criticisms of the very early stages of the whatever field you're studying in, and identify the key thinkers, and then focus on the things that they can't explain. And that's what I do as a researcher, and that's what I have done with Moses, and that's what I did with Atlantis. And I certainly do believe, I agree with you, that Antarctica, there's a lot going on down there. And there is my latest curiosity portal, is what I call a speed of light code, and it's in the last chapter of an e-book we wrote called From Atlantis to the Promised Land. And that's where I am right now. I'm working into a new Curiosity Portal.
Cool.
Yeah,
the Curiosity Portal for Moses was the deaths of Aaron's son being incinerated, which I found to be really, really so odd that just got me curious.
What was your most recent discovery? Because I couldn't
imagine.
Well,
I think it was when you measure the speed of light in nautical miles, it prints out a code.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1618, which is the first four digits of phi. 749, which is the speed of light goes around the Earth in 7.49 seconds. And then 77, 49, 77. So there's seven sevens in it. And the Earth's speed, spin of its axis has been calibrated to print out a universal constant, phi, and the speed at which the Earth's orbit goes around the sun is 10 phi. So it's like going an average of 16.07 nautical miles per second. So we believe that both the spin and the orbital velocity of the Earth has been created. It's not the result of bouncing around, and it's not the residue of the creation of the solar system. It is a calibrated thing.
Right.
The way that this happened is that to design the perfect second that would print out. That you have to have the Earth spin at exactly the right velocity to be able to print out a perfect 1 second. And then you have to have the time, the system. And the time system that we have, 24 hours, 60 minutes, 60 seconds, that all comes from the Sumerian gods. And they're the ones who basically have conditioned us to determine what a second is.
Mm.
And a second is how fast does light travel in 1 second? 1,618,74.499. And all those numbers are universal constants.
Hmm.
So our planet's spin and orbital velocity has been created, rather than being the residue of us bouncing around. In other words, there is an intelligence in the universe that has the capability of determining the planetary speeds and their speed on their axis and their speed around the sun that they're going around.
Hmm. That's an interesting premise.
Yeah,
so that's what I'm working on now.
Cool. That's great. Well,
what are you working on, Tony? Nothing like that.
I'm going to get my hair cut. No, it's
kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
I feel very short here on this answer. But well, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're out of time. But you're fascinating. All your best to your wife and yourself. Please always think of us, and when your next book comes out, we'd love to have you back. But this was
okay.
A very fascinating subject, the murder of Moses. Please go out and pick it up. I just love to hear, you know, research of people. We've had people on talking about Jesus being the great grandson of Cleopatra, and you know, many topics. So it's fascinating to hear this research of people. So, but thank you so much, Rand, for being on the show.
Well, thanks, Tony, and thanks, Captain Ron.
Thanks, bud.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. We really appreciate you always, and always suggest guests for us. We love to hear from you. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel and also share it. We'd love to share this episode. Subscribe to our Apple podcast, and iHeartRadio and all the other app platforms. So until next time, I'm Tony Sweet with Captain Ron for Truth Be Told. Take care.